a vehicle to bring down the national government and resume his rightful place as president. Just to go through the functions of these of the four upper houses, formal upper houses that we have, I included Tasmania for a little vanity, as well as the fact that I included it in your chart. Some of the interesting features of it. Fiji, for example, the Senate cannot initiate legislation, but it has the power to amend it and to review or delay it. It has some powers of executive oversight, or we think it will do. It's, of course, suspended since December 06. And it has a role in providing ministers. In the case of the Marshals, the House of Arroyos, as I said, is essentially advisory, although because it can request some bills, I said it may have some power to delay legislation by simple fact of requesting to review the legislation before it's passed by the lower house or by the national parliament. Palau basically is almost as powerful as the Senate, but the interesting feature of it is that where I've said protecting the federal balance, as I know with emphasis, it's because it's the lower house that represents the states. The 16 states of Palau are have one member each to the lower house. That's the whole of the lower house. And they have 9 members from geographically defined constituencies. So it's a federal system, but the lower house represents the federal compact, as it were. And like the, because it has a separation of powers, of course, no member of the cabinet can be a member of the Congress. The interesting feature, and I have to direct you back to your colored chart for this, is the SFM, the Federated States of Micronesia, is a definite federal state with 6 quite autonomous member states. But it has no second chamber to represent the federal compact at all. And I'm not quite sure how the FSM actually works out these, other than perhaps through their unicameral. What I found particularly interesting was, until John forced me to look at it, the role of these Council of Chiefs in it. As I said, the traditional political order is recognized in a separate house in nearly a third of the fix, Fiji, the Marshals, Palau, and Vanuatu. And as I said, it's not the full extent because, for example, the Solomons have Council of Chief at a provincial level. Samoa, after the change in the after a referendum, I think it was 1991, has universal suffrage. Before that, suffrage was limited to chiefs. Now suffrage is universal, but only chiefs can be elected. And in Tonga, the nobility, I think it's 34 titles held by 32 individuals because 2 have joint titles. Is that right? Lopi's gone. They elect a third of the parliament. So it's a very Whig kind of parliament, at least before it's been reformed, the Tongan parliament was. The commoners get to elect a third of the parliament. The nobility gets to elect a third of the parliament, and the king gets to appoint a third of the parliament. You know, what could be fairer than that? In the Cooks, the House of Ariki is described in their literature as a parliamentary chamber, but it's purely advisory, and the parliament itself is officially listed as unicameral. It's said that the Cooks, House of Ariki was set up purely to keep the chiefs out of mischief, but in both the Cooks and Vanuatu, as well as Palau, and I'll leave out Fiji from this, they all have a role of advising at least the national parliament on custom and the effect of legislation on custom and what it might do. And again, it is advisory. However, and I found this curious, again, one of those things that you find, John, when you're forced by colleagues to look at things you hadn't looked at for a long time. This year, the House of Ariki actually attempted a coup, at least some members of it, declaring the government overthrown, and they were going to run the cooks from this advisory chamber, the House of Ariki. The police laughed and everybody had a good beer, and a couple of weeks later the Parliament went back to its normal business as scheduled without any worries. But it just raised the point about this question of legitimacy in a post-independence order. As I say, the interesting thing also for me was the tricameralism that occurred. Two bicameral states, Fiji and Palau, do maintain this third house. As I say, the Palau's is purely advisory, but the Great Council of Chiefs, Mbose Levu Vakaturanga, is quite a different matter. It does have real power. It elects the president and the vice president. It appoints more than 40% of the Senate, and it has veto power over changes to land law and by increasing practice over constitutional change. So it's an extremely powerful thing. And this is a result of the coups, particularly in 87. In fact, the Frank Bainimarama at least argues that his coup is a counter-coup because he's trying to roll back these undemocratic changes that have been imposed by the previous coups. Some conclusions briefly to finish up. Upper houses, as I said, are very rare amongst the Fix. Only three of the 14 states have them, and one of these three is basically advisory. I'm not sure that I would count it. The informal national chambers for traditional leaders are just as common. And these, basically the second and third houses do not focus on the executive. They exist to protect custom. They don't have the role of the upper house as being an oversight or sober second thought or restraint on the executive. Perhaps, if you like, a sober second thought in a weak sort of way with regard to custom, but not to general legislation. It's not entirely clear whether this was intended to preserve custom or to contain it. Certainly in the case of Fiji, it started out that way, but as I say, the coups changed the balance. The House of Ariki would like to have more power, and they've made that clear this year in a very peculiar sort of way. So there is some risk that having created the chambers, even if they're meant to contain it or to marginalize the chiefly influences, they've actually legitimated them to some extent and given them some sort of influence in the national political process and perhaps in the national legislative process. So apart from Fiji, there probably is little scope for the major theme of your conference, John, of strengthening Parliament through the institutional role of upper houses. But probably Fiji is the large enough issue to worry about, because I think clearly we would like to see Parliament restored in Fiji as soon as possible and to have it work in an effective and democratic way. Thank you very much.
Richard.
Stephen.
Well, thank you very much, John. Now, as you see, I've entitled my paper Innovations in Bicameralism, but added a significant question mark there. Now, it's certainly the case that there's been a great deal of innovation happening in Indonesia, both in terms of general political change, constitutional change, but also in our particular focus on parliamentary institutions and the question of bicameralism is very much at the centre of that. But the question mark really relates to whether or not it's bicameralism. Now, as you'll see, this is one of the themes that I pursue in this paper, because perhaps it's a contradiction in terms, but Indonesia today has two chambers, but it's not bicameral. It perhaps even has three chambers. And I want to talk a little bit about what I mean when I talk about that, because I use the phrase second legislative chamber quite deliberately, because I wouldn't describe the second legislative chamber in Indonesia as an upper house by any means. And it's involved in the legislative process. So yes, it is a legislative chamber, but Is it a second chamber as it's usually understood? Well, that's very much a moot point. All right, now these lines were supposed to come on sequentially under my control, but somehow it's failed. My control over PowerPoint is not sufficient. But anyway, thank you. But how do I go to the slideshow? No. Okay.
Right down there.
Okay. All right. Now it's obeying my command. Thank you. Now, I first of all wanted to go into a little bit of background about what's been happening in Indonesia. First of all, because I know everybody here is not an Indonesianist, may not be familiar with many of these things. But secondly, and most importantly, I wanted to talk a little bit about the political dynamics of the last 10 years in Indonesia, because I think you cannot understand what's been happening in institutional terms without understanding the politics of it. And I thought it's important for us just to remind ourselves of a few very, very basic things. Indonesia is the world's fourth largest country. This is a fact that I think not many people often remember. Indonesia, for a country of its size, has not had very much prominence on the world stage. And the scale of things, I think, is often forgotten. And indeed now, after political reform, it's now the third largest democracy in the world. The really key feature of what's been happening in Indonesia is 10 years of what I would argue is successful democratic transition. I'm referring here to some of the democratisation transition literature, which have talked about the third wave of democracy and so forth. This has been, Larry Diamond has made the observation a few years ago that there's been some rollback, as he called it, of democratisation, looking at various countries that previously had appeared to be making progress in terms of development of democratic institutions, but have slipped back somewhat. But this is certainly not the case in Indonesia. What we see today is that the country has established the basic infrastructure of democracy, and moving now on perhaps to a second level of consolidation of democracy, moving on to more basic questions of governance, how these institutions actually work. And I would argue that possibly Indonesia now could be described as Southeast Asia's healthiest democracy. This point really occurred to me just after the coup in Thailand, and I just had a quick mental look around the region, and I thought, well, actually, Indonesia is not looking too bad. And I've started to say this more often to Indonesians, somewhat often to their surprise, because they always tend to assume that, oh, of course, Indonesia will be lagging behind. But actually, if you look at Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, let's forget Burma and Vietnam and so forth, Indonesia now is looking more and more healthy in terms not just of basic democratic institutions, not just the ritual of democracy like elections. It's now actually developing quite healthy institutions of governance. And for our purposes, a really important aspect of that is that constitutional reform and democratisation have transformed legislative institutions. So very quickly, what have been the developments since 1998? 1998 being the year in which the Suharto regime fell. First of all, the development of a new political culture. The media was very quickly freed up. New political parties grew up very, very quickly. Political movements grew up very, very quickly. The political culture, the political scene in Indonesia is now so different from what it was just less than a decade ago. One very, very important feature of that, in constitutional terms, in terms of constitutional change, has been direct popular election of the president. So now the theoretical separation of powers that existed in the Indonesian constitution have now really become a lot more of a fact, because the legislature and the executive are elected separately. And this has brought about a change from, well, it's one of the factors that has brought about a change from the previous rubber stamp parliament that we had before 1998 to a more democratic parliament operating increasingly in a system of separation of powers, a classic presidential system. And this has led to an increasingly activist parliament, not necessarily, with a parliament with many problems in its actual functioning, but more and more confident of its capacity and its right and legitimacy to assert itself in relation to executive government. It still exists under, I think, the predominance of executive government, but is developing more of its own confidence. And it's also made much more interesting by the fact that there is no party in the parliament with a majority. Final important thing we need to talk about, and it's important for the second chamber, is part of the movement of democratisation, the development of a democratic culture, was a revulsion against the centralism of the Suharto regime. And so there has been a devolution of powers away from Jakarta. Not a federal system, but much more powers now to elected assemblies and elected governments in the provinces and districts. Focusing our subject a little bit further to constitutional reform and its effect on the legislature, I ask the question, have we really gone from bicameralism to tricameralism? Because before 1998, there was bicameralism of a sort. There was, first of all, the House of People's Representatives, the DPR. Usually the people just say the DPR, use that acronym. But, of course, it was fully appointed by the President. And although it had legislative functions, oversight functions, these powers existed largely in theory. Occasionally, the DPR, the House of Representatives, asserted some independence, but basically its powers were theoretical only. But in addition, there was also a People's Consultative Council, which was composed of the DPR, the Parliament, and, very much in inverted commas, social group and regional representatives, in inverted commas, because they were all actually just hand-picked by the President. This body chose the President, so the President had to be elected by the MPR, but strangely enough, it always seemed to be the same person that they elected. So in theory, this was the highest body, but again, only in theory. It also had the power to amend the Constitution, and although it didn't actually pass laws, it did have a supra legislative function. It passed decrees and a thing called the Guidelines of State Policy, which was meant to be the framework within which the Parliament would then pass legislation. So it sort of had a legislative function as well. So in theory, it was quite a powerful body. The institutions acted in the way in which they were supposed to, then it would have been a very powerful body. Now, after constitutional reform, going from bicameralism to tricameralism again, well, sort of, very much a question mark. After 1998, actually, I would argue that we have unicameralism. We have unicameralism, but like Richard has pointed out, in the Pacific, there's complications. And in fact, it's quite interesting to see how, despite the very, very different circumstances of Indonesia and the South Pacific, I see similar sorts of phenomena developing. Bicameralism, tricameralism. In this case, basically a unicameral system, but two extra chambers that we need to take account of. Really, the Parliament can be said to be the DPR, the House of Representatives, now elected by PR, by popular election. It passes legislation. I put there laws because I wanted to point out that in the Indonesian legal system there is this very rigid hierarchy of forms of legislation, and laws are one part of that hierarchy, and that's the responsibility of the DPR. And constitutional reform has also given the DPR some additional powers of oversight of executive government. But now we're getting really to the point of this paper. In addition, there is now a House of Regional Representatives. This is a House elected by popular election, by the single non-transferable vote system, but it can draft legislation but not pass it. It's restricted to regional issues. It can provide advice on legislation to the DPR and advice on oversight of the executive. But the House, the third House, the People's Consultative Council, the MPR, still exists, but it exists in a greatly weakened form. It no longer passes decrees. Decrees no longer exist in the legal hierarchy, no longer passes the Guidelines of State Policy. It has the power to, or the function to ceremonially inaugurate the president, and it can initiate impeachment. That is a potentially powerful function, but it's a complicated process that I don't have time to go into. Its most important function now is to amend the Constitution. And it's composed of the members of the DPR and the DPD. I stress here the members of it. In other words, it's not a joint sitting of both houses, but all of the members assemble annually in meetings of the NPR. And there's also now, as I said, a whole series of regional legislatures. There is devolution of power, but not federalism. That's an important point to remember for the reality of the operation of the second chamber. All right, well, what were the politics of this change, the politics of amendment of the Constitution and the amendment of the provisions in relation to legislatures? First of all, there was a desire to reduce or to eliminate the powers because it was seen as a relic of authoritarianism. The NPR was seen as historically being one of the main instruments by which Suharto gained power and then consolidated power and then held on to power. And in fact, he was able to do that because, arguably, because of the deeply anti-democratic philosophical origins, actually, of that chamber. This idea of social group representatives, political representatives and regional representatives had its origins in German Romanticism and in particular in the wartime period of Japanese occupation and ideas of Japanese corporatism. This is something which is a bit sort of embarrassing to many people, that some of the origins of this assembly and some of the ideas about its composition. But to some extent that was part of the tools that provided the possibility for 35 years of authoritarianism. So it was seen necessary to get rid of that. Secondly, and alongside that, was a perceived need to increase the powers of the House of Representatives to those which were appropriate for a presidential democracy. A presidential democracy, i.e. separation of powers, and, of course, for a democracy. Therefore, there is now in the Constitution an explicit recognition of the DPR's powers to make laws. Previously, the Constitution actually said the President made the laws with the agreement of Parliament. Now it says the Parliament makes the laws. And, as I said, a range of new powers to give the Parliament more real power to oversee the executive. The politics of reform to create the DPD was, in general terms, a perceived need to create a second chamber to represent regional aspirations. So a little bit more detail on that, of the politics of the formation of the second chamber, the DPD. Now, as I mentioned, there was a strong feeling after the end of the Suharto regime that there needed to be a devolution of power and more regional input into the legislative process and, in general terms, to the political process. Secondly, there was a perceived need to replace the regional representation that did exist in the old NPR. And in reality also, some of the key people who were pushing for the formation of the DPD were the old leaders in the NPR. They wanted to have a job. They wanted to keep being players in the political system, and some of the reasons why the DPD actually was formed was because it was pushed by these powerful people who wanted to see themselves continuing to have a role in the political system. I think it's quite interesting how it's just an example of how major constitutional changes can set in concrete quite passing political configurations. Many people here would be familiar with that phenomenon. It's many of those in the Australian Constitution, like the location of Canberra, for example. But there was very strong opposition from the formation of a regional chamber from those who are usually called nationalists in Indonesian political parlance, especially PDIP, that is Megawati Sukarno Putri's party. They saw it as promoting separatist tendencies and strongly opposed it. Arguably, of course, it could actually reduce separatist tendencies, but that's not how they saw it. The result of that was a compromise, and a compromise which produced a very weak chamber. So if Indonesia is bicameral today, it is, in Indonesian political parlance, soft bicameralism. And I use this term, I think it's a terrible term, but it is the term that is usually used to describe the two chambers in Indonesia today amongst Indonesian political analysts, amongst the political class. It is claimed that there is soft bicameralism in Indonesia. I would say, actually, it's unicameralism. Well, very quickly, the powers of the DPD. As I said, it is a very weak chamber. Has the power to propose bills, that is, draft bills, on a limited range of areas: regional autonomy, central regional relations, creation of new region, management of natural resources, and the financial balance between the centre and the regions. It can also participate in the discussion of bills on those matters above, and also provide advice to the DPR, the House of Representatives, on the state budget and bills on taxation, education and religion. And it has the formal power to oversee the implementation of laws on all of those above matters. Having considered those matters, it can submit the results of its oversight to the Parliament for the Parliament's consideration. So this very much raises the question, is the DPD an upper house? It's no surprises from what I've been saying that I don't think it is, because it has only advisory powers. It cannot pass a bill. It cannot reject legislation. Its proposed amendments to any bill take the form of suggestions only. It cannot compel the DPR to consider its bills or to consider its amendments. And it also cannot compel the DPR to consider its advice. In the process of oversight of the executive, it can invite government representatives, ministers and officials, but it can't compel them to appear. So, yes, a second chamber, but not an upper house. Well, there's a very interesting feature, though, of the DPD. It then revolves around this whole question of legitimacy that comes from popular election. Because despite its limited powers, the DPD does have a very strong sense, or its members do have a very strong sense, of their representativeness and their legitimacy. Both of those things, their representativeness and their legitimacy. But the electoral system is politely, I would describe, as idiosyncratic. Now, first of all, there is equal representation for each province. Now, the provinces of Indonesia range in size from about 500,000 people up to 35 million. So there is a huge discrepancy in size of provinces, but each province has four representatives. And also, a single non-transferable vote system, as I shall show in a minute, leads to some quite odd results. But finally, and perhaps I think, it's amongst the factors that add up to a very unusual chamber that has a lot of questions about its operation, is the fact that candidates must be, quote-unquote, independent. That means that they cannot be leaders of political parties, they can't be endorsed by, they can't be funded by political parties. They can, however, be members of political parties. Now, this phrase is something that you will hear again and again if you talk to people in the DPR or political analysts about the DPR of a particular persuasion, that the DPD represents the people, whereas the DPR, that is, the House of Representatives, just represents the parties. So somehow the DPD has more legitimacy because people vote for individual candidates, whereas in the DPR, in the Parliament, people vote for parties, and the parties very much dominate the electoral system in the DPR. This is the situation. More legitimate, more representative. But as we know, representation is a very slippery concept. What exactly does representation mean? I don't have time to go into the that analytical question, but that's the background to the next section of the paper that I want to talk about. Because very many different electoral systems produce differently composed assemblies. And this, of course, refers to some of the discussion that we had in the previous session, that the electoral system will have a great effect on the sort of chamber that you end up with. And, as it has been observed, the results may not be what the designers intended. And this is certainly the case in the DPD, in the case of the DPD. So the second chamber in the Indonesian constitutional setup has an unusual combination of popular legitimacy but very little power. I would contrast that with other upper houses around the world that may, for example, like the Australian and US Senate, have strong powers and strong popular legitimacy that comes from direct election, or strong powers but weak legitimacy, therefore a reluctance to exercise those powers, such as in Canada and Spain, because there is an appointed upper house. Or there may be limited powers and weak legitimacy from being appointed, a case I know of being Ireland. So the DPD is possibly unique in having limited powers, but strong popular legitimacy that comes from direct election. And the DPD, though, is not unusual in its regional focus. All right, just a brief discussion then about intercameral relations. How does the second chamber, the DPD, interact with the DPR? Well, this is almost it's a free translation, my free translation of the legislation which oversees the operation between the two chambers. And that legislation says that the DPR invites the DPD to discuss the DPD's proposed bills, here's the key, of course, in accordance with procedures determined by the DPR. In other words, it's the DPR, the Parliament, or the lower chamber, that decides. Now, these bills that are to be discussed by each House are, in theory, divided up in a mechanism called the National Legislative Program, which is agreed between the DPR, the DPD and executive government. But it's no surprise that it's executive government first, DPR second and DPD third in order of influence in that process. Now, theoretically, according to the rules, discussion with the DPD takes place before the DPR, the Parliament, begins discussion on a bill with the government. This should give the DPD some influence. In other words, from the ground up, the DPD should be involved in the discussion of and drafting of bills in which are within its purview. Advice from the DPD on matters within its purview is to be regarded as material for the DPD to take up for further consideration. In other words, they can ignore it if they like. It's just for their further consideration. And in practice, these relations are still evolving, and they're marked by an unwillingness by the Parliament to take notice of the DPD's input. And this, of course, is hardly surprising, given the limited powers. I mentioned some of the idiosyncrasies of the electoral system. One of those effects is that the DPD is strongly biased towards representatives from eastern Indonesia. That although the six provinces of Java make up 60% of the population, they receive only 24 seats, or 19% of representation. Whereas, because eastern Indonesia is made up of a lot of small provinces that total only 20% of the population, it receives 50% of the representation in the DPD. So this is oddity number one. Now, combined with that are the effects of the single non-transferable vote system. That is, that you have a choice just of one candidate out of potentially a very long list of candidates. And in large provinces, of course, there's a very long list of candidates. This means that candidates are elected to the DPD often, or usually, with a very small percentage of the popular vote. Only four members have anything more than 20% of the vote in their province, and 80%, sorry, 60% actually receive less than 10% of the vote in their province. So does that create a representative chamber? Question mark. The other side of that is a very high percentage of wasted votes. If you just have a look at the worst example of that for the sake of time, you'll see that in something like 60% of provinces, about three quarters of the vote is wasted. In other words, in that number of provinces, three quarters of the people did not vote for any of the candidates who are supposed to be their representatives in the DPD. So who are the members of the DPD? What is their background? A lot of people from a Golkar background, that is the political party that dominated things under the Suharto regime. This is a little bit like the comebacks of the former communist parties. They, even though they, of course, are not under that party label, everybody knows their background. And many of those have a civil service or military or public official background. A lot of business people. Because the campaign for the DPD is a costly thing and can only be done as an individual, it is dominated by people who have the resources behind them. Reasonably interesting number of religious figures and people of an aristocratic, for want of a better term, adat meaning traditional law background. And a large group of people from a background in academia, in the law, in NGOs, community organisations. 21% are women, which compares quite favourably with the DPR. And an interesting thing is that the DPD, many members of the DPD see that body as an opening into regional politics. And many serving members of the DPD have stood in governor and district elections. That's quite interesting. They don't see their membership of the DPD as significant enough to serve out their full terms. A large number have gone into these elections. And I was actually present in a DPD plenary meeting in which the speaker read out the names of these people, not because he thought this would be an embarrassing thing, but because everybody clapped. Wow, isn't that wonderful? All these people are now going on to better, bigger and better things. That didn't say to me very much about their perception of the importance of their work in the DPD. So, all these things together, how do you make a chamber like this work, particularly a non-party assembly? The DPD is organised around provincial delegations. If you go into the offices in the DPD, each of the four members are grouped around a single antechamber. So there is an assumption that somehow they act as delegates from their province, even though, of course, they actually have vastly different political backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds. Now, there are some special interest caucuses, but they're very, very loose. Now, the principal problem, of course, is there is complete absence of the discipline that is brought by political parties. Frequently, of course, strong party discipline is criticised in so much literature. But the reality is that existence of political parties brings discipline, predictability in policy making, but all of that is absent. And in many ways, actually, the DPD, in my opinion, acts like a chamber of 128 different political parties. All right, I'm running out of time, so I won't dwell too much on this. The basic point being that the DPD has achieved very little in 4 years. It's a house in search of a role, but I did want to spend just a little bit of what time I've got left talking about international experience and how it might actually shed some light on how the DPD may operate. Now, I do this with some trepidation because I don't think there's any capacity to, you know, there's no big lessons that can be mechanically transferred. But I think it may be interesting to look at international comparisons. And I also do so with a bit of trepidation because I know there's people in this room who have worked a hell of a lot more on second chambers than I have. But I put this before you. Now, a point that I didn't actually get a chance to emphasise enough was that, in my opinion, the members of the DPD have wasted a huge amount of time in trying to reform the Chamber, trying to reform this body that's just been set up, because they see the reality of the very, very weak powers, and they have expended a great deal of intellectual energy and physical energy in trying to reform the Constitution. But I think international experience would show us that reform of legislative institutions is very slow and very difficult to achieve. Despite all the efforts and criticism of the Canadian Senate, it remains unelected. If we look at the case of Australia, the Labor Party now has long abandoned the long-held ambition that it had to reform or even abolish the Senate. I mean, it was part of the Labor Party's platform for years and years, completely forgotten now, because nobody wanted to expend the effort that would be involved in actually doing it. Similarly, the reform of the UK House of Lords took a generation. The Labor Party was pushing on this for so many years before it actually achieved anything like the change it wants. And it's particularly difficult to achieve reform if reform of the Constitution is necessary. And as I said, the DPD has expended a great deal of energy on this rather fruitless task, and it would arguably have been more productive for them to try to produce some results produce some maybe modest but noticeable results, which would then back their case for some sort of political change. And it also would be the case that I think a more powerful DPD would no longer be the non-partisan sort of institution that many members of the DPD like to emphasise as a positive feature of the DPD. They see the fact that it's non-partisan as providing the opportunities for better consideration of debate, less strident debate and so forth. But if it became more powerful, it probably would lose that feature. So it can't have both. Now, can the DPD actually be a regional chamber? It's supposed to be. It's in its very name. It has this explicit constitutional focus on regional issues. But will this make it a chamber that actually speaks with a regional voice? That is, speaks with a regional voice as distinct from just focusing on regional issues. And I would argue that chambers that are elected by the people of a region are almost inevitably more partisan than regional chambers that are chosen by regional legislatures or by governments. If you look at the case of the Bundesrat in Germany, the South African National Council, a very, very regional character, focusing on regional issues because they actually are elected from the regions by the legislature or the government. Whereas the Australian Senate, the US Senate, popularly elected by the people, are much more politically partisan, or party political partisan. And the Australian Senate, of course, has never ever voted on state lines. So given that, given the difficulties of making it into a truly regional chamber, given the fact that it has a constitutional focus to look at regional issues, I would argue that it should attempt to build some sort of connections with the provincial assemblies. There's also a very important point about second chambers. The experience of second chambers seems to suggest that they can establish some influence, as distinct from power, an influential role by specialising in some sort of subject or function. The House of Lords often is said to have a record of contributing to legal reform, concentrating on a range of ethical issues. I think perhaps one could talk about this in relation to the Australian Senate and the estimates process. And so I read, individual senators' expertise is often seen as a strength of the US Senate. I would defer to other people in this room about how true that is. Of course, to achieve that, we need a strong committee system. To develop specialist roles, we need workable committees. DPD committees, however, are much too large. There's only four of them. Their functions are very unclear and they overlap. And then, of course, there is this problem of, in effect, the 128 different parties. So how you get coherent results, coherent solutions in a committee system like that, is very much an open question. But the DPD could, as I said before, use this sort of role to demonstrate that it can make a contribution. That is, for example, it could draft some good quality bills and apply pressure on the DPD and the executive to take up these ideas, even if they knew that it might not get passed. But what they need to be doing is developing effective media and interest group strategies so that they can actually connect with public discourse, connect with lobby groups pushing on certain areas, and therefore exercise some sort of influence as distinct from power. And of course, it seems to me that a second chamber has really arrived in political terms if the first chamber and or the executive is actually forced to consider what the second chamber's reaction might be to any action that it's taking. That is, that preemptively they have to think, what will this chamber do? If that starts to happen, then a second chamber is becoming effective. So in conclusion, yes, the DPD was part of the process of democratic consolidation in Indonesia, but as a result of a compromise between a desire for devolution and fears about separatism, it ended up with only very limited advisory powers. And we can see, like many of the countries of the Pacific, Indonesia now does not fit neat categories of unicameralism versus bicameralism. And the idiosyncratic composition and electoral system raise serious issues about the internal effectiveness of the DPD and also about its representativeness. Unfortunately, however, the efforts of many members, particularly the leadership of the DPD, to bring about constitutional reform to increase their powers have diverted attention from finding a role with existing powers, because after all, this body has only been in existence for less than 5 years. I interviewed the Speaker of the Chamber a couple of years ago, and he told me he thought he could bring about these constitutional reforms within the next 2 years. I laughed to myself at the time. It was clearly unrealistic, but it's taken a great deal of energy in the effort. And so the achievements to date have been very modest. So in conclusion, yes, there are two or even three chambers in the Indonesian political system, but bicameralism is definitely not yet a feature of Indonesian politics. Okay.
Stephen, thank you. There are two fine comparative papers that have taken us a long way offshore, deep offshore. Comments, responses, questions, Stan.
Stephen, your description of Indonesia, you know, is so simple and intuitively obvious. I'll ask a question of Richard instead. Fiji, Richard. This is an example of a little knowledge being a dangerous thing. I understand Fiji to be a very bifurcated society, the Fijians and the Indian population. And I wonder if there's any comparison with Belgium. There may be people here who know the Belgian Senate better than I, but I have this vague recollection that it's been reconstituted to really reflect the division within the Belgian society, in which basically each community has an effective veto through its powers in the Senate. Could you comment on the role of the Senate in Fiji as a body that can deal with this ethnic historic division in the society? And does the existence of this third house, you know, tilt the balance?
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks. Is that working?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. To explain a bit more, I was trying to keep within time, so I did skip over a few things. The Fiji Senate, when it was in existence, was entirely appointed. So it's appointed by the Great Council of Chiefs, the leader of the the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition, and the people of Rotuma. Council of Rotuma. So it's an appointed second house. It was created in part to create another pool of talent so that a bit perhaps, well, I don't know if the Canadian Senate was, but certainly in the case of Fiji, staffing the executive was easier if the government could appoint senators and then used them as cabinet ministers and still maintained the Westminster system and so forth. The interesting thing is, I guess from my point of view, your question is based on a false premise. Yes, Fiji is bifurcated along ethnic lines, or at least it was. But when the Fiji Labour Party originally gained power in the mid-80s and broke down those ethnic divisions, that's when people on the ethnic side, particularly the ethno-nationalists amongst the Fijians, got very nervous. That people would not vote on ethnic lines, but in fact would vote on issue lines. And so that's why Bavandra was overthrown, in effect. And Rabuka's response was to not build up the Senate, but rather build up the Great Council of Chiefs, which he subsequently became the chairman of, by the way. So he did a very traditional Fijian thing. He was a young warrior who knocked off the chief and acquired the mantle of the chief and became a chief himself. And he's now a life member, as is Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, of the Great Council of Chiefs. That's why they get to use her physiognomy on the coins and so forth, because she's actually a member of the Great Council of Chiefs, although I don't know that she's aware of that. But the interesting thing, what happened was the ethnic divisions really did fracture after that point. The Alliance Party, which was basically a Fijian-dominated party, has been replaced by a succession of a variety of different parties with more or less the nationalist objective. The Indo-Fijians have fractured. And so I was involved for the first 6 months of this year in the People's Charter process of restoring parliamentary democracy in Fiji as an advisor on the electoral process. And the interesting thing for me in terms of the way the ethnic balance has now changed was that the electoral system for which I drafted the final paper to go to the National Council was to have a form of PR that was non-racially based. There were no reserve seats, just straightforward PR. The Indo-Fijians in the groups, some were worried about this, and most of them, however, said in a very thoughtful way, we don't care if we're in the minority as long as we get respect and inclusion. Now, I'm not sure, there's certainly Mahendra Chaudhry and others on the Indo-Fijian side don't necessarily share that. They see political advantage in having reserved seats for their party and using ethnicity as a basis for that. But it was interesting. The people who were supportive of change wanted a free democratic system that wasn't racially based, and they were perfectly prepared to trade off the consequences of that, which is now that the Fijians, indigenous Fijians, are in the majority, that they would trade that off for just respect and inclusion in the country. And I don't know how to answer it. I'm just saying it's more fractured than simply the two. And the Senate really doesn't figure in that. And after the court case today, my concern would be that the interim government will now choose to impose the charter, which is part of the reason I left the process, because I don't think it can be imposed or should be imposed, but that they will impose it and it will suffer a great deal of resistance, but we'll see about that.
Yeah. Stephen, do you want to buy in on the Belgium business? Mm-hmm. Ethnic religious cleavage in upper houses? No?
Not at the moment.
Okay. Somebody at the back of the room? I think Campbell is pointing. I can't see. That's tomorrow's story. It's another tomorrow story. Yeah. Lynn.
I was actually going to follow up with Stephen. All through your talk, my familiarity with Indonesia has become less so in the last 10 years, so I'm not really sure what's happening there. But in a lot of travels around the place, I've come across a lot of hostility in the regions towards Jakarta and the Javanese, and I just and the fact that with Transmigrasi they have been there's a genuine belief, well there was, that it was predominantly the Jakartanese and to some extent the Javanese who were moving into the regions and taking over the control, getting the best lands, taking the businesses. Just wondered whether that has been had any impact on the kind of regional representation that's going on in the central parliament, whether the unity and diversity process that you know I studied 30 years ago has improved somewhat, whether the people who are being supposedly represented are the ethnic groups that come from the different regions, the different provinces, or whether it's largely, you know, people who've moved originally from Jakarta or Java out to the regions who are coming back as the representatives.
Yes, well, you were certainly accurate in your observation about antagonism towards Jakarta, but I think there's two aspects of it that are intertwined, but I think it's useful to distinguish with the two, and that is animosity towards or friction that had come about between groups who had transmigrated from Java and Madura to other parts of the country. Sometimes that happened quite smoothly without local antagonism and animosities being generated, but on other occasions it didn't work smoothly and hasn't worked smoothly. That's one element of that feeling. But secondly, there was also what I described in my paper as a revulsion against the centralisation of power in Jakarta. So it's not particularly an anti-Javanese thing, except that Jakarta is located on Java, but it's not a cultural ethnic antagonism. It's a political antagonism towards decision-making being monopolised by the central government in Jakarta. And second, that latter thing, as well as the former, were an important part of the motivation for the establishment of the DPD. I think that's undoubtedly the case. More important was the general devolution of powers to the provinces and to the districts, and the creation of democratically elected provincial and district assemblies, and now direct election of governors and bupatis. That's a more important element of that, but the DPD is part of that feeling that along with, well, democratisation or needs to come a devolution of power, or another way of putting it would be to say, well, what does democracy mean if we can't make decisions about our own region, our own district? It's probably a better way to put it. That was the sort of question that people were asking, and there was a very strong sentiment for taking away the monopolisation of power by Jakarta. I think that has worked to a considerable extent, not particularly because of the formation of the DPD, but more because of the provincial assemblies. And a particular example of that I would cite would be the case of Papua. Now, in the last 5 years or so, Papuan secessionism has almost completely died. It's marginalised. It still exists, of course. And if there were people from OPM here, they'd be jumping up and down about what I said. But I think the reality is that it's now very, very marginal in Papuan politics. And a lot of the reason for that is that now there is a Papuan governor in the three provinces, or the two provinces in Papua. There are now district heads who are Papuans. People can see that they now have non-Javanese people that they can go to. The policy makers who are developing their policy, providing services, have Melanesian faces. It's no longer the Javanese that dominate things.
Stephen. Avanish in the corner, and then Yusaku immediately. No? Just waving. Hi. Yes. I can see you.
Hello. I want to ask two questions on Fiji because I come from there.
Yeah.
Firstly, would Fiji be better off without the Senate? Because it seems that they are the ones who have been holding much of the power. And secondly, when you mentioned about the new government or the interim government is trying to push things, and you know whatever their intentions are, but when will the right time be? Because if you go back to the parliament, and the same cycles will start again. So when will be the best time to have changes introduced? Thank you.
Did I wish you'd asked me that at the beginning of this year. I was, as Brian Custer said, I was much more optimistic then about the prospects. I don't know when the best time for change will be. I'm deeply concerned that this process of democratic review called the People's Charter, instead of being an informative part of a political dialogue process, is now being insisted upon. And it's what Bainimarama had to say when he gave his address to the United Nations a few weeks ago. Basically, that it's the price of admission. And I don't think it's the price that the people like Gerasse and others, Beddoes and others, are willing to pay. So I think it will make things more difficult, and that's why I mentioned the court's decision today. I think that this could seriously complicate it by making the interim government believe that they have an avenue forward which won't involve the parliament, that simply rests on the presidency, President Iloilo, and the use of his reserve powers. And if they do that, again, they will simply entrench, I think, the opposition to change. It really, the Senate, I don't believe, has been the source of the problem. The real problem is that if you've been to Suva, of course, you've seen the new Great Council of Chiefs building. It's massive. It really competes with any of the parliamentary buildings. And yet this is a body which does not operate on a democratic basis, that has been behind most of the apartheid legislation in the parliament, or promoted it, certainly been the beneficiary of the ultranationalist coups, including obviously Speights in 2000. So in a lot of ways, I have some sympathy for Bainimarama's attempt to reform the Great Council of Chiefs and put it back in the box, as it were. But again, that has deepened that ethnic divide, Stan, that you were asking about in some ways, because obviously the more the Great Council of Chiefs has become entrenched as a central organ of Fiji politics, the more it's been able to pursue an ethnic-based agenda. And I don't think it, unless the Indo-Fijian community simply rolls over and accepts the situation. For example, Gerasse, for the in the short time he was in power, roughly 5 years, took back nearly a third, or between a quarter and a third, of the freehold land during that period. There wasn't much of it, only about 16%, I think, available, and he took back 4%, so a quarter of it. You know, and with the Gully Gully Bill and things like that, it really, those are centered more on the Great Council of Chiefs, not on the Senate. So, I mean, the Senate may be a way of doing as in the other Pacific Islands, when I was drawing to the Council of Chiefs arrangements in other Pacific Islands, it might be a way of giving some expression to that in a more manageable way. But the it's the tricameral bit that's been particularly damaging, not the bicameral, I guess.
In the spirit of bicameralism, I'll take two final questions. Meg and Ricardo. Ricardo and Meg.
I had two questions myself, actually.
That's bicameralism.
Menus abbondare quam deficere. The first is for Stephen. Stephen, isn't it true that at some point the DPD wanted to pursue an anti-corruption agenda and say we are the anti-corruption institution and that's our basis for legitimacy and that's how we want to increase our institutional power and capacity? Second question for Richard. You said that you were advising the Fijians to adopt a proportional representation electoral system. The problem of PR we know from the literature is that it's not able, has no constraining effect, it's not capacity to curb fragmentation. If I'm not mistaken, fragmentation in the Fijian parliament before the democratic breakdown was already considerable. There were 7 or 8 parties. So the point is, when you're advising PR, aren't you afraid that by adopting PR instead of first past the post, you're going to increase the number of parties and make the government unable to work? And so when you propose PR, do you recommend small districts, small magnitude, or thresholds to curve with?
Yes, it certainly was the case that at one stage the DPD did announce that it was pursuing an anti-corruption strategy. It's one of a number of initiatives that it launched. The problem, of course, that it has, though, is how. How does it, as an institution, have an effect on the problem of corruption? In what way does it work? Does it pass a bill? Well, does it draft a bill? Well, yes, it can draft a bill, but the DPR can ignore it if it wants to and is wont to do so. And, in fact, the system is even more rigid than is suggested by the way I just put it then. For a bill to be considered, it has to go into the National Legislative Program, which is a cumbersome, rigid sort of process. So, yes, it could draft a bill, but what effect it would have, I don't know. The only way it could make it that effective is by using the media. And what I've observed about the DPD, the leadership of the DPD, is that it's loath to do so, doesn't yet appear to have understood the possibilities of using media-based strategies to put pressure on the other chamber or to put pressure on executive government. Partly, I think, that is because, as I mentioned, a lot of its leaders are products of the new order, that is, the old order. They're products of the Suharto regime. They very much look at politics as a series of backroom deals. Politics are done behind closed doors. So many of the leadership haven't really adapted to democratic politics. So the question then really is, this is fine, have an anti-corruption strategy, but what can they actually do? In reality, what's happening in relation to corruption in Indonesia today is very encouraging, but it's happening because of what the Constitutional Court is doing, because of what the Anti-Corruption Commission is doing. In other words, a range of extra-parliamentary bodies have taken up that and are putting a lot of pressure actually on legislative chambers, because many of the people who have been brought to cases by the Anti-Corruption Commission have been legislators, both regional and central. So, yes, it's done that, but I would see that just as an example of the difficulty that it has in actually having any impact.
That very quickly. Ricardo, the point of the PR system is, in fact, to produce a fairly large number of parties, to fracture this increasingly crystallized majority that the ethno-nationalists have, and have a parliament where outcomes have to be negotiated in a way which more moderate parties will dominate the agenda, rather than the what's happened in Fiji is that the SDL, the party that ran the previous government, was able to have a majority and control the parliament and run an ethno, and it was that party was confected from a moderate party which was larger than the nationalist. But the ethno-nationalists, the strong ones, were able to basically use the party structure to seize the agenda. So the whole point of it is, in fact, to try and fracture that and offer some security to the minority Indo-Fijians to say that, yeah, you won't have a crystallized majority gang up against you if you work within this new kind of framework. So the whole point of it is to do what you were concerned about. Some are concerned that it'll make government stability more problematic, but I would argue since the coup of 1987, we don't know what governmental stability looks like in Fiji except an oppressive one, so why not?
Thanks, Richard. Last comment or question from Meg.
Meg Russell, University College London. Thank you for both of the papers, which were very interesting, two areas of the world that I don't know enough about, so I'm grateful to you. I had a question for Stephen about this large group of independent members in this chamber. One of the things which distinguishes the House of Lords is that it contains roughly 200 independent members, and I find this very interesting, and I've studied them, but of course, it seems like Indonesia is running us a good close second, and it's a great deal easier to find independent members in an appointed system than in an elected system. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about the dynamic of how those elections have worked, and just to pick up something that you mentioned, that some of these people are associated with interest groups. Are interest groups getting into running candidates for the elections? Because that obviously raises the question of, when is a party not a party, given that one of the things that distinguishes parties from non-parties is the fact that they run people for elections? And would that be policed in some way if they started to run people for election in Indonesia?
Thank you.
Yeah, well, just to clarify, we're not talking about a large group of independents within the DPD. One has to be an independent. Yeah, okay. Well, part of the problem in answering that question is that we only have one election as our example. But I would agree really with the point that you're getting at, that it will increasingly become a fiction, that either people will... in order for somebody to run as a true independent, they have to be able to finance themselves, which is an extremely difficult thing to do. And as I mentioned in passing, that to some extent, in my opinion, accounts for the large numbers of business people who are actually in the chamber, 50 that I've identified out of 128. And either that or they have some sort of local stature, some sort of local profile by being a religious leader, a local aristocratic figure, tribal figure. Or they will represent some sort of interest group, or they will have a political party background. Because after all, remember, it is not against the rules to be a member of a political party, only to be a leader. How one defines that, of course, is a question. So, yes, I would agree that... All this system really does is create a lot of impediments to the effective functioning of the chamber, and over the course of a number of elections, I suspect we will see an increasing number of people with an identifiable interest group, political party background as elections proceed. It does not define it. And what the Constitution says is that they will be individual candidates. And for the DPR, for the Parliament, it says they will be... the candidates will be political parties. So the fact that of the domination, the very stated domination of political parties in the Parliament, is part of the reaction that made a lot of people see that some sort of antidote to that would be to have independent, quote-unquote, candidates. And the Constitution says candidates shall be individuals.
We've come to an end. I know you're keen to stay, but I'm going to tell you to go. Before I tell you to go or advise you how to go, could I call upon David Sullivan to give us any advice we need in order to get to the front of the building now that it's slightly after 5 p.m. and I don't know whether the building's technically open. To hand in the pass, surrender the pass as you leave?
Passing.
Right.
Security desk, and you'll need to collect the pass again tomorrow morning. So it's the same procedure tomorrow morning when you come in the building. So you'll be fine. Just straight through these doors, down to the front entrance, down the marble stairs.
Thank you, David. 8:30 tomorrow morning, Tony Mugan will be here to entertain and enliven us. He'll take us through to 9:15. Then there'll be even more of the festivities that will continue. Please join me in thanking the last panel.
Aren't we having a reception?
Yeah, there are drinks on.